Hey everyone, welcome to the Cross to Crown podcast. My name is Doug Gooden, I'm your host. Before we get into the topic today, I want to alert you to a couple of resources that are appropriate to today's topic. The first is a book I wrote years ago called God's Design for Marriage, What You Need to Know Before You Say I Do. It is for pre-married couples, and I describe it as premarital counseling in a book. It covers all the major biblical theological themes as well as practical things, and it's designed to get couples talking to one another. So every few pages, there's a stop and discuss portion, and I have found as a pastor that having couples read through this together and engage with the questions with each other before or while I'm meeting with them saves a lot of time and lets us drill down into the most important topics, but I also know that they get the whole content of what I want for them. So that might be a resource that you would like to get a hold of. December is the time when the most people get engaged, and so maybe you want to get it for someone as a Christmas gift. The other resource is also called God's Design for Marriage. It's the red one, so the premarital version is the blue one. The red one is for married couples, and it covers basically the same content, although adjusted for married couples, and I took out the parts that are unique to pre-married couples and added an expanded chapter on sexuality. So if you and your wife want a refresher, if you want a new resource, something to go through together that could be encouraging for your marriage, then I would encourage you to pick up God's Design for Marriage, the red version. And you can get both of those on Amazon or at our website, crosstocrown.org. And that leads us into today's topic for the podcast. Today we continue the seven core responsibilities of manhood, and today we talk about the fifth one, which is to make love. Today we're continuing our look at the seven core responsibilities of manhood, and today we come to number five, which is to make love. Now, if you are single, you may be tempted to turn this off because this may sound like it's one of the core responsibilities for husbands and not so much for single men. And that is true from the perspective of the actual act. As Christian men who are single, your call is holy sexuality, which means you are not to be pursuing sex with a woman. However, the things that we're going to look at today, I don't think will be a temptation for you, but instead will help you become the kind of man who will be more attractive to women and will prepare you to be better as a husband if the Lord should provide that for you. So I would encourage you, give it a chance, give it a listen, but if you decide to pass on this one, then I'll understand why. So we're gonna talk about making love. We're gonna talk about sexuality. This is a topic that men like to talk about, but we're often hesitant to. And there's a variety of reasons for that, and I won't get into all of it, but I want to just affirm to you here at the beginning of this that as a man, your sexual desire is good. God gave it to you. It's not something to be ashamed of. It's not something to dismiss. Again, we have to keep sexuality within the confines of biblical righteousness for sure, but within that that realm, it is good. It's God-given. God blesses it. God gave it to you to enjoy. You should not be ashamed before your wife or anyone else to acknowledge that you enjoy sex, that you're interested in sex. It's part of who God made us as human beings, both men and women. And our world, our culture, wants to minimize and indeed, I would say, criticize and almost condemn male sexuality, while at the same time amplifying and liberating female sexuality. That is all the result of cultural Marxism and feminism and all that. And again, we're not going to go down that path and unpack all of that and explain historically how we got here, but just be aware
that that's what you're going to find in media, that's what you're going to find in movies, that's what the world is saying. Man is toxically masculine, and he's just a sex-crazy beast. Women need to be free to express themselves. No, within the confines of marriage, sexuality is good for both men and women. And as a man, you should not be ashamed of this. We know this because the Bible has lots to say about sexuality. God mentions sexual things throughout his word. Think about how the beginning of the Bible is a man and a woman who are naked and unashamed, and they become one flesh. That's at the very beginning of the book. And God says, that's very good. He created Adam and Eve and gave them no clothes and commanded them, told them to become one flesh. That's part of what it means to be married. That's the defining act of marriage. And then at the end of the scripture, what we're waiting for is our king to return and take his bride and consummate the relationship, which, now this can be taken too far, but the subtle imagery is, it's the bedchamber, the marriage bed. It's the idea of consummating the relationship, which is sexual in nature. Now, don't take that beyond the imagery that's laid out there in the book of Revelation, but the point is, in terms of our sexuality as men, it's blessed by God, it's good. And if that's not enough to convince you, there's an entire book of the Bible devoted to married sexuality. Now, I know historically there have been theologians and pastors and scholars who've tried to make the Song of Solomon about Christ and the church or some other sort of spiritualized kind of idea. Yes, everything points to Christ and the church, which means our sexuality points to Christ and the church, and our married sexuality points to Christ and the church. But the book of Song of Solomon is about married sexuality. And that's how you should read it. That's why God gave it to us. And it's an entire book of the Bible devoted to this one thing. Well, we don't have time to go through the entire book, but I'm going to spend some time just on the first four verses of chapter 1. There is so much here that if we get it, it may transform this part of our married lives. So first of all, I want to start off with the title itself. Now, I've been referring to it here as the Song of Solomon, but it's actually, the first line is the Song of Songs. We are familiar with this construction where the same word is used twice, first time in the singular, second time in the plural, with of in between. It is an indicator of raising something to the superlative degree. For instance, Jesus, one of his titles is King of Kings. You're familiar with that, right? Of all the kings that exist in the world, Jesus is the king of those kings. Solomon uses the same construction in Ecclesiastes, where he says, vanity of vanities. All is vanity. He's saying of all the things that are vain in this world, I'm going to describe the most vain of them all. When Solomon calls this the Song of Songs, he is saying of all the songs that I've written, and the scripture tells us he wrote over 1,000 of them, of all of those songs, this is the best. This is the greatest. This one surpasses them all. And it's about married sexuality. God created sex to be good. We are to enjoy it. We are to do it the way he's designed it. So that's how it begins. Now, I'm going to refer to these first four verses. And that was verse 1, actually. And I'm going to use the New English Translation, the NET Bible, because Song of Songs is poetry. And poetry, as you know, is open to a varieties of interpretations and even translations. And so much of what you think is going on impacts your translation of this. This is why if you compare many translations, you'll see there's quite a bit of a variety on how different scholars translate these things. Well, I'm persuaded that the NET does a better job than most on this particular book. So I'm going to use the NET. It begins in verse 2 with the woman, the bride, speaking. And here's what she says. Oh, how I wish you would kiss me passionately, for your lovemaking is more delightful than wine. Now, I just said that I prefer the NET over the other translations because I think it's more accurate, but I already have a disagreement with verse 2. I would actually prefer the other translations on verse 2 for this reason. In the original, this first line, oh, how I wish you would kiss me passionately, that line is actually spoken in the third person, where she's expressing a wish, a desire to be kissed. That's important because I think what is being communicated here is this is all in her head. This is in her heart. This is unspoken. And I stress that because it's easy for us as men in this culture to think that women should be the initiators. I hear husbands all the time saying, I wish my wife would initiate sex more. That would be great. That'd be fine. And maybe you're one of those men that has a wife who does that. But most women keep their sexual thoughts inside, at least with their husbands. Now, they've been trained by the world to be as overt and uninhibited as possible in teenage years, in college years, that kind of thing. We see that all over the place in the world. But even for the most promiscuous women, husbands complain after they get married that they start to pull in, they start to withdraw. And again, there may be various reasons for that, but at least one of them is most women, not all necessarily, but most women are more inhibited in their expression. Now, it's not that they're less sexual than men, but they don't speak about it as much. So she thinks in her mind, in her heart, oh, I wish he would kiss me passionately. It is very likely, my brother, that your wife desires sex with you more than she lets on. I think we can use this as a model. You should at least test the theory. And then she says why she wants him to kiss her, because she says, your lovemaking is more delightful than wine. Now, you need to understand what wine meant in that culture. This, just trace wine through the scripture. Wine was the symbol of celebration. You remember Jesus, his very first miracle that is recorded is when he turned water into wine. And what was the occasion? A wedding feast, a wedding celebration. Everyone was there celebrating the fact that this couple was coming together. And what were they going to do? They're going to have sex. They're married now. And everybody was celebrating this union. And they needed wine to do it. Wine is this symbol of festivity, of joy. It delights man's heart. It makes us glad, the scripture says. It's a tool to refresh and revive. Now, we can easily attach the most negative stigma just to people getting drunk, and the Bible warns against drunkenness, of course. It's a sin. But we also have to realize that throughout the Bible, a little bit of wine is actually intoxicating in a non-sinful way, but in a very joyous, celebratory way. And she says, making love to him, to my husband, is more intoxicating, more thrilling, more reviving than wine. Again, let that sink in. This is a woman thinking first that she wants to be kissed and then saying in the first person, this is why, because making love to you is more invigorating than the best wine. Women are not less sexual and less, they don't enjoy sex less than men. We have to let that sink in. I said earlier that the world encourages women to explore and exploit their sexuality as much as they can, and it wants to condemn men for their sexuality. In the church, we tend to have this view that women are less sexual, that they're less sexually interested than men are. And that's just not an assumption that we should make. That's not what we see in the scripture. It's not what we see in the world. And my guess is, even though women are a little more inhibited, generally speaking, in their expression, that inside they're no less interested in sexuality than we are. Again, I'm drawing this from my own experience with my wife, but also from this text of scripture. Now, what is it that has made this woman so interested in being with her husband, making love to her husband? Why is she right now saying, oh, I wish he would kiss me? Again, I know I just keep beating on our culture, but our culture gets so many things wrong. If you read all the books today, you would expect that this text is going to go on to say it's because he lavished great gifts on her. He took her out on dates. He discovered what her love language is, and he spoke that language over and over again. He just romanced her and romanced her and romanced her, and now she just wants to get all over him. That's not what the text says. And I'm going to suggest to you that that is not what sparks a woman's sexuality. All of those things may be important. Romance, cherishing, giving gifts, that all fits in the Ephesians 5 category, in my view, of nourishing and cherishing. We are to give good gifts to our wives because we represent Christ, and we are to care for them and provide for them. And I love to buy gifts for my wife. I love to go on dates with my wife. I love to romance her. And I think sometimes men are more romantic than women. And all of that's good, and every husband should do those things. But where the mistake, where the error comes in, is thinking that those are the things that arouse a wife. According to this text, it's not what she's aroused by. Here's what she says, verse 3. The fragrance of your colognes is delightful. Your name is like the finest perfume. Okay, so let me explain this. First of all, she talks here twice about cologne, perfume, that kind of thing. We have to remember the setting. This was back before they had indoor plumbing, so men could not take showers every day. Even rich men didn't bathe themselves every day. So cologne, perfume, oils, they were used to make men smell better, and women too. It was part of that. So one thing we do need to learn from this is women are very tuned in to smells. If you don't smell good, you are not attracting your wife. So take a shower. Take a shower regularly. Use soap. Use shampoo. Use some cologne. Smell good. She will want to be closer to you if you smell good. I was counseling a young couple one time, and the man had a job where he was, shall we say, dealing with sewage and that kind of thing on a daily basis. And he admitted to showering a couple times a week, maybe. And then he was kind of puzzled why his wife was not so interested in him physically. Well, at least one reason is he probably needed to smell better. Take a shower, smell good. She says this, but there's more to it than that. In that day, in that culture, perfumes, colognes, oils were very, very expensive. You had to have some money to be able to afford them. She is not only or simply saying, I want to be close to him because he smells good, but this is a man who has been successful. Now, you may be thinking right now, am I just a success object? Is she just wants me for my money, for my pocketbook? No, it's not that. Don't paint this in the worst possible way. Think of it like this. Women are drawn to men who are leaders, who are kings. We're going to see that here in the text, who are decision makers, who are accomplished and successful. Now, you don't have to be more successful than everybody else. You just need to have enough success, enough prosperity, where it's attractive to your wife. So again, don't compare yourself to any other standard. Just be the kind of man we've been talking about all along. Be productive. Get stuff done. Accomplish things. Pursue your mission. Cultivate the garden you've been placed in and be a protector and a provider. Be kingly. Make decisions. And you'll find that that is arousing and attractive to your wife. It's what the woman says. Your name, she says, is like the finest perfume. You've made a name. She says, you've made a name for yourself in your job, in some aspect of life. You're somebody. Women are attracted. This is God's design. This is not does not make women superficial. This is God's design. He made women to be attracted to men who are living out all of these things we've been talking about, to be successful, to be accomplished, to have a name that is worth something in some arena. And again, don't think you have to live up to anybody else's standard. Just progress in your job and in some effort where you are successful, and that will be attractive to your wife. It's what she says. And notice what she says at the end of verse 3. No wonder the young women adore you. Think about this. This wife sees the young maidens and how they adore her husband. And that makes him more attractive to her. He's not flirting with those young maidens. He's not doing anything inappropriate with those young women. He's just the kind of man that if he were single, all of these young women would want to be with him. They would want to be the wife. So what we learn here is, be the kind of man that if you weren't married to your wife, there are other women who would be interested in being the missus, and that is attractive to your wife. And again, there's nothing superficial, there's nothing inappropriate about this. It's just true. It's part of how God designed women. They want to be with a man that other women would want to be with if the opportunity was there. And just to double qualify, I'm not suggesting for a moment that it's ever okay to flirt with, to pursue a relationship with someone you're not married to. That's not the point. But your wife will know intuitively, as she watches how you carry yourself, she will know whether you could be attractive to other women, and she will see when there are other women around, even in very safe spaces, so to speak, that they look at you and they smile and they react to your jokes and they see that you're successful. She'll see that, and that's part of what would attract her to him. That's what she says. No wonder the young women adore you. And down in verse 4, the women say, we will rejoice and delight in you. We will praise your love more than wine. And then again, the wife comes back and says, how rightly the women adore you. Now, beginning of verse 4, she says, draw me after you. Let us hurry. May the king bring me into his bedroom chambers. Here again, it's in her heart, in her head. She doesn't say this out loud. I know it sounds like it here, but she's actually, it's all inside, and she's wanting him to take her into the chamber. She wants him to take her sexually. I said this is one of her core responsibilities, to make love. Husband, I'm telling you, don't wait on your wife. Single men, pursue girls, pursue dating, pursue women for the hope of marriage, not pursuing them sexually, but pursue them for whatever you want to call it, dating, courtship, pursue them for marriage. You be the initiator of the relationship. And then when you are married, you be the initiator of your sexuality. Most women are hesitant to initiate. Men, they want their husband to do it. She looks at him as a king, as an accomplished man, as a leader, as somebody, and now she's just waiting. Please take me. Please draw me into the bedroom now. That's part of our responsibility, part of our mission. I just wonder sometimes, as I hear from husbands and wives, how much joy and pleasure in the marriage bed is lost for both of you because men don't take the initiative. You talk yourself out of it. You look for signs that she's interested. Again, all this is going on in her head. How is he supposed to know this? He doesn't. He just takes charge of his relationship with his wife and initiates. And many wives are longing for their husbands to be proactive, to be strong, to be leaders in the bedroom. Husbands, it's one of our core responsibilities. We are told not to deprive one another. And I want to challenge you that you may be depriving your wife by being hesitant and reticent to pursue her sexually. Be like this king. Be a man that attracts her, and then go and get her.